Transformation of America by Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien. Chapter 15, No More Beating Around the Bush. It was a sunny, fall day in 1983 when U.S. Congressman Guy Vanderjagt met with my CIA operative mind control handler, Alex Houston, my then 3/1/2-year-old daughter, Kelly, and me on the steps of the U.S. Senate in Washington, D.C. Kelly appeared familiar with Vanderjagt, although I had never previously remembered seeing her in his company. Even so, I could not think to realize he was, in fact, sexually abusing her just as he had me when I was a child. Vanderjagt knelt on one knee in front of her to talk with her, assuring her that today was a special day, because she would see Uncle George, Bush, while Mommy sees Uncle Ronnie, Reagan. He stood up and took her by the hand, saying in Alice in Wonderland cryptic language, "Let's go on an adventure together," and led her quietly and robotically away. I met up with Kelly again that afternoon at the White House, both of us literally on our toes, and standing at attention in Reagan's office. In retrospect, I wonder at the measures of control inflicted on my 3/1/2-year-old child to cause her to perform so robotically and behave so well, as she silently stood with the plastic smile and unblinking eyes, in the presence of President Reagan, Vice President Bush, and, later Defense Secretary, Dick Cheney. Reagan appeared to gaze at Kelly, with her long blonde hair cascading down the back of her blue pinafore dress, completing her Alice in Wonderland appearance. Reagan seemed to pose no direct threat to her sexually as he said, "She is adorable. A model child." Reagan then gestured towards Bush and said, "This is my Vice President George Bush. People don't usually know what the role of the Vice President is because he's always behind the scenes making sure everything that the President wants done happens the way it's supposed to." He looked at me and said matter-of-factly, "I catch the public's attention." He made a gesture in the air that was eye-catching, while the Vice President carries out orders. Bush's close friend, Dick Cheney, said, "And gives them." "Right," Reagan said, "an order from him is like an order from me." Bush was wearing canvas boat shoes and a cardigan sweater as he knelt on one knee in front of Kelly in order to talk to her on her level. Bush used the children's television program Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood to scramble/confuse young victims like Kelly's memory of contact with him and his sexual abuse. His physical resemblance to TV's Fred Rogers was deliberately exaggerated by his choice of clothes and mannerisms, and is further compounded by his developed vocal impersonation. Using his best Mr. Rogers voice, he said, "Come here, little one. I want to ask you something. Do you watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?"
"Yes, sir," Kelly responded.
Bush told Kelly, "Well, I'm kind of like Mr. Rogers when he makes his puppets move and talk like your daddy, Houston, ventriloquist, does with Elmer, his dummy. Only I'm like Mr. Rogers because I have lots of puppets, only mine are people. I even have a king, Fart, just like Mr. Rogers. When I pull the strings, he pantomimed marionette hand movements, and I talk through them. They say my words and we create all kinds of exciting adventures. Right now I'm building a new neighborhood, the New World Order. The stage is set, and I have hold of everyone's strings. I need you to help me. Together we can pull your mother's strings. She's in my neighborhood. That means you're in my neighborhood, too." It seems obvious to me now that Bush was referring to those actively engaged in implementing the New World Order through chaos and mass mind control, also known as media conditioning, as the neighborhood. Of course, I was unable to consider disputing Bush's statement, and Kelly was certainly not of mind to see beyond Bush's twist on her favorite television program. Kelly's big blue eyes grew even wider as she responded, "I am." Bush stood up and took her hand. "Come on, dear, let me show you my neighborhood." He led her out the door. Kelly became violently physically ill after her induction into George Bush's neighborhood, and from every sexual encounter she had with him thereafter.
She ran 1046 degree temperatures, vomited and endured immobilizing headaches for an average of 3 days, as is consistent with high voltage trauma. These were the only telltale evidences aside from the scarring burns left on her skin. Houston forbade me to call a doctor, and Kelly forbade me to comfort her, pitifully complaining that her head hurt too bad to even move. And she did not move for hours on end. Kelly often complained of severe kidney pain, and her rectum usually bled for a day or two after Bush sexually abused her. My own mind control victimization rendered me unable to help or protect her. Seeing my child in such horrible condition drove my own wedge of insanity in deeper, perpetuating my total inability to affect her needs until our rescue by Mark Phillips in 1988. Kelly's bleeding rectum was but one of many physical indicators of George Bush's pedophile perversions. I have overheard him speak blatantly of his sexual abuse of her on many occasions. He used this and threats to her life to pull my strings and control me. The psychological ramifications of being raped by a pedophile president are mind-shattering enough, but reportedly Bush further reinforced his traumas to Kelly's mind with sophisticated NASA electronic and drug mind control devices. Bush also instilled the, "Who ya gonna call?" and, "I'll be watching you," binds on Kelly, further reinforcing her sense of helplessness. The systematic tortures and traumas I endured as a child now seem trite in comparison to the brutal physical and psychological devastation that George Bush inflicted on my daughter. As soon as the door closed behind Bush and Kelly, Dick Cheney reached over to Reagan's desk from his seat and flipped over the hourglass. "Ounce, her, Kelly's, time is running out. You'd better pay attention and follow orders as though her life depends on it. Because from now on, hey hey, it always does. If you make one mistake one then I'll get her, my pretty." Reagan said, "George is like a director. He makes sure the stage is set to implement the new world order as I envision it. Then he makes sure everyone has a script and knows their pan. He tells them how to speak and when to speak it. How to dress and, patting my head, how to wear their hair. He gets everything and everyone in place and hollers, 'Action!' exclamation," Reagan shouted through his hand as though it were a megaphone and rambled on, "All the world's a stage. I'm the wizard. But he is directing the show, so you better pay attention and learn your part well from him." Cheney interrupted, "George and I will be working closely on a few projects together, and when you see him, you'll see me. When you're given orders from him, you're given orders from me." "She knows the chain of command, Dick," Reagan injected, referring to his perception of who was in charge, and in what order. President, Vice President, Habib, Cheney, Byrd, etc. may have been the chain of command in Reagan's mind, but Cheney's definition was necessary to my understanding. From my perspective, the chain of command was clearly Bush, Cheney, Habib, Reagan, Aquino and lastly, on a par with my handler, Houston, Byrd, all of which was subject to change at any given moment. Cheney just rolled his eyes at Reagan's comment and never slowed down as he continued, "Right now a stage is being set and you will be directed by the Vice President on just how he wants you to do your part in setting the stage for Mexico's role in the New World Order." Reagan jumped in again, "With the world in order, there will be world peace. By strategically placing an American patriot dedicated to the cause of spreading democracy in all parts of the world, we can influence the thinking of every nation's leader and paint for them a picture of freedom and American values that they'll never forget. They'll spread it to the people and the whole planet will be of one mind, one purpose, one cause. Freedom. You'll be talking with some of these friends and leaders from time to time on my behalf." Bush slipped back into the meeting, "Without Kelly?" Cheney continued, "Taking orders from me and your new director, the Vice President. Lesson number one. You know what Miami Vice is? Undercover drug agents taking control of the drug industry. A vice president is just that, an undercover drug agent taking control of the drug industry for the president. Bush spoke up, "Mexico is a problem. They've got lots of drugs, but not the brains nor the means to sell it outside their own country. So how can we take control of their growing drug industry when we can't even get our hands on it? It's your duty as an American citizen to open the roots and initiate freedom from poverty throughout their nation by offering them cash as a means of enticing their drug industry right into our grasp by bringing it right up to our doorsteps." "Operation Greenbacks for Wetbacks," Cheney said, laughing. Bush laughed with him. Bush regained his composure to conclude, "Your assignment begins in Miami with NCL, Norwegian Caribbean Lines, and ends when you return from Mexico with word of success." Cheney caught my eye with a hand gesture that directed my gaze from Bush to the hourglass, which was running out fast. By then I was deeply tranced and lost touch with my surroundings altogether, while my trance was timelessly deepened for further programming. I left the White House with a message for the Vice President of Mexico, Carlos Salinas de Gortari, from the Vice President of the U.S. And with one very sick child. 1. Mr. Roger projects through puppets on his show, and one of his key characters from the land of make-believe is King Friday the 13th.